Hello nerds, welcome to this bonus episode of Into the Wild. It's Ryan here. Do I need to say that? I don't think I need to say that anymore. I mean, it's been 4 and a bit years. If there's anyone listening going, who the hell is this guy? It's not Nadia, it's not Oscar, it's Ryan. I'm just very quickly recording a little introduction to today's bonus episode. I'm in a very echoey room, so I do apologise that it's out of my control, but my voice won't be here for very long, so thanks for your patience on that. Now, I'm super excited to bring you this conversation. I recorded it 6 months ago, which is very embarrassing. It's taken me this long to edit it. You know, life gets in the way, work is very busy, so I do apologise, especially to our guest, that this has taken so long to come out. But here we are. It is here. This is a conversation with a wonderful project leader and community representative, a man by the name of Jean Wiener. I'm also, by the way, sorry, I must say, when I started the interview back in November when I was talking to Jean, I pronounced his name Jean. And that's because I'm an English London lad, and it's what we do. We butcher names, all right? So I'm so sorry to Jean for ruining his name and calling him Jean. It's Jean. Jean is, like I said, a community representative and a project leader in Haiti. Now, when we talk about community conservation and biodiversity and the climate crisis, I don't know about you lot, but I very rarely hear the country of Haiti come up. So I was super fascinated to learn about how this all, how conservation works in a country like this, and what kind of projects are undergo. So, but before we get onto that, let me just tell you how I met Jean. So Jean is a 2015 Whitley Fund for Nature Award winner. Now, if you haven't heard of the Whitley Fund for Nature, look them up. They are fantastic. They fund community conservation projects predominantly in the Global South. And I was lucky enough to go to the awards last year, which are coming up this May for 2024. So again, look them up. You can watch them live on YouTube. They're a wonderful celebratory evening, recognising people on the ground doing incredible projects with people and wildlife conservation. But I met Jean in the Whitley Fund for Nature's People for Planet Summit, which was in autumn last year, where he was on a panel talking about biodiversity credits. Do they work? If they're not working, why? What he thinks needs to change and how they work in Haiti and stuff, which is something we talk about in this interview. But the reason why I was so excited to talk to Jean was because it was an opportunity to learn about a country like Haiti. Now, I didn't know a lot about what happens in a country like this. I didn't know much about it politically, socially, environmentally. So it was really kind of, I felt like I was opening my eyes for the first time. I was just there to really learn. And I'm sure many of you listening now might be in that same position. And it's incredible really to hear from Jean about him and his team, the work they do and achieve in a country that has such high levels of political and social instability. You know, we can sit here and appreciate how challenging conservation and community-based conservation can be at the best of times, let alone when you're, you know, you've got high stress and challenge levels, like, you know, political and social issues like that as well. So this was, it was a beautiful chat, and it was a pleasure to listen back to it whilst I was editing and kind of have that reminder of it 6 months ago. I am sorry again. So this is quite simply a bonus episode from Into the Wild called Community Conservation in Haiti. Enjoy, and I'll talk to you at the end. Well, welcome to the show, Jean. I've already asked this, but how are you? Are you well?
Thanks for having me on the show, Ryan. I appreciate it.
No worries. Did you, I've got to ask, and the listeners will be aware of this because of my intro, but did you have a good time at the Whitley Fund for Nature People for Planet Summit? Did you have a good
yes,
time there?
Of course. It's great to be a part of such a wonderful organization, and I've been related with them, if you will, since about 2006 when I won my first associate's award with them. So it's been quite a while, and third time in the UK, in London, for these kinds of meetings since I came up in 2008 for the quote-unquote first Whitley Award, in 2014 for the Gold Award, and then of course this time for the 30th anniversary, which was again a great event, wonderful event.
It was wonderful, wasn't it? I said to the guys from Whitley, I said, you know what, as someone that has been immersed working in and just interested in conservation for a while around the world, that's one of the first kind of those events that I've seen with that level of accessibility, mm-hmm. kind of thing. It was so easy for anyone to just attend and just to really get a good understanding of some projects around the world, some really open and honest conversations about some like hard things sometimes. And I just felt it was really, I just had that feeling of, I wish I was going to this when I was in college. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's a great setup. And they really, really want to make it as open as possible for everyone and anyone to attend. Nothing, you know, exclusive here. Lots of people from around the world, of course, coming. And it's just, you know, get the word out. And people such as myself, of course, appreciate all of that, to be able to get the word out as well about all the work that we're doing. And very friendly people, very nice. I mean, it's just a great event all around. As you said, anybody can come and anybody can enjoy the ceremony.
Yeah, it's really good fun. And yeah, it's just something I really enjoyed, and just getting to meet and network with people. Let's start with this obvious question as well that I've forgotten to ask already. Is, do you want to start by telling everyone who you are and what you do?
Well, my name is Jean Wiener, and I was born and raised in Haiti. I studied for a while in the United States and then returned to Haiti to begin the Fondation pour la Protection de la Biodiversité Marine, so the Foundation for the Protection of Marine Biodiversity. It was just figuring out that nobody was undertaking any type of work related to protecting and managing Haiti's coastal and marine environment. And I had grown up going to the beach, in the water all the time, you know, one of those kids in which you usually had to yell and scream at them when it was time to go home at the end of the day to get out of the water, and refuse to get out of the water. Yeah, and we'd come out looking like prunes. So being in the water all the time, I always saw the coral reefs, the fishes, yeah, and all the wildlife. But then even over the years growing up, from a young age when I first started in the water at probably about 5 or 6, and then up until leaving for university at 17, seeing the decrease in the coral reefs, in the amount of fish, the increase in marine pollution. So again, being always incredibly interested in the coastal and marine environment and the ocean, studied marine biology at university, and then went back. And as I said before, that's when I realized that nobody was taking care of a Caribbean island nation's coastal and marine resources. So started up FOPROBIM, as it's now known, the acronym. And that was 32 years ago and have been working at it since. So we're working on mangroves and coral reefs, fishes and fisheries, fishermen, coastal communities, trying to just ensure that, you know, everybody finds what they want. As I had said during the Whitley Fund event there, we need to make sure that a lot of the time people we are working with understand that we're on the same team. You ask a fisherman, you know, what do you want? And the fisherman will tell you, well, I want more resources. I want more fish. I want to see more fish. And it's exactly what we want. We want to see more fish. We want to see the resources in good condition so that the fishermen can continue to find enough fish. And all of that takes a real serious holistic approach. You have to work on the mangroves, on the coral reefs, on the seagrass beds, on the fisheries, on the fishermen. You have to bring in government agencies, because they're the ones who are the only ones who have the legal authorities to designate new laws, to enforce laws. So you really have to really have all of these different pieces come together and really working together to be able to move forward, and for the fishermen to have more fish, tourism, the tourism industry to have the nice beaches they like, the kids in local communities to have clear water to swim in, the fish to have, you know, mangrove areas that serve as nurseries to lay their eggs in, coral reefs again for tourists and for the fish to for the fish and the fishermen to be able to breed in and for tourists to see and all of that. So it's really not a simple process, especially in a country like Haiti. We're going through a particularly difficult time right now, although it never seems that the news out of Haiti is ever good. But right now, we're having a particularly difficult time. So it's great to be able to work on this.
Excuse my ignorance on this, because I haven't. What is the situation in Haiti at the moment? When we say it's a difficult time, what's the current difficult time for Haiti?
Well, the current difficult time is over the past. It's been a bad time since about 1986, when the Duvaliers were expelled. The dictatorship was overthrown. I know that a lot of people don't like to hear, you know, say that, you know, when you look back at the Duvalier era as the good old days, yeah, you know you're really in trouble.
Yeah, I can imagine.
We had bad times during the Duvalier period as well. My grandfather, for example, you know, was imprisoned and beaten and things like that. So it's not like we're longing for the Duvalier era, but there was peace and safety and security otherwise. You know, as long as you didn't go into politics, you were fine. But since then, you know, we've had, I mean, people talk about having, you know, 7 coups d'etats in 100 years. For us, it was basically coup du jour. You'd wake up every day and be like, okay, who's in charge this morning?
Jesus.
So societal...
Worse than the conservative government here.
No, by far. So you'd wake up. I mean, I remember waking up when I was younger and asking my mother, you know, like, so who's in charge? Or she'd wake me up and say, you know, he's gone. And I'd know what she was talking about, because there'd be a thick covering of black smoke from tires burning from roadblocks, you know, covering the city.
Jesus.
So political instability over the years, the social fabric of the country has really begun to unravel.
Yeah.
Because of the disparity between the rich and the poor. Again, things like earthquakes, hurricanes. And then the human disasters, which are constantly striking the country or taking hold in the country, it's all making it a very, very difficult situation in which to work. And of course, the people who are suffering the most are the people who can least afford it, at the very bottom of the ladder. And right now, again, we have gangs running wild through the country, throughout the country. We have about 250,000 people internally displaced, I believe, because the gangs have gone into neighborhoods and kicked them out.
Wow.
Burnt their houses, kidnapping people, killing people, disrupting transportation, fuel delivery, all of that type of thing. So that's the context in which we're working right now. And it's not easy. It was very difficult before, and right now, of course, it's a lot worse. And when this type of situation is prevalent and continues as it does now in Haiti, it just makes our work all the more important, because a lot of people depend on us, a lot of people are waiting for us to help, and we are almost their only lifeline. They can't count on the government for anything. They were never able to before, and right now even less. So we're almost their only lifeline to be able to undertake any type of activities related to trying to make their lives better.
And like, so with that kind of political and social, I guess, I mean, if this is the right word, the instability or the kind of, you know, battles and challenges that Haiti's under, for you saying like the conservation approach is, you know, a very holistic approach, that must make your job and other people's jobs for conservation even harder if, you know, if the threats to people are more direct and immediate on the surface, then tackling things like conservation must be a real uphill battle for you guys at times.
Oh, absolutely. In countries similar to Haiti's, of course, and I can guarantee you others as well, if they're going through socioeconomic and political upheaval, when the economy starts to go bad, the first thing that is attacked, if you will, are the natural resources. People, you know, if you can't afford or there's no availability, for example, of propane, people are going to start cutting down trees for fuel wood. If, you know, you can't get into your fields because either a gang has taken over the area or due to climate change, for example, it's either a flood or a drought, you may head into the ocean to go fishing. And because you don't know how to fish, you may start to use various methods which are extremely damaging to the environment and to the resources. So once there's political instability, socioeconomic trouble, you know, all of those, the natural resources are going to be the first to be impacted. And it's going to be extremely difficult, of course, to try to reverse that and try to explain to people that, you know, it's hard to, you know, you shouldn't cut down that tree. Well,
yeah.
You know, I have a family to feed. Yeah, I have a family to feed, and I have a doctor's bill to pay, and I need to eat. You put that fish back. It's too small. Well, if I don't take this fish today, I'm not going to eat today. So the dire situations that we're facing every day are extreme, and, you know, they need to be dealt with delicately as well. The one thing I really don't appreciate is, particularly in Haiti, of course, is my greatest experience, is when you have members of the diaspora who may have lived overseas for a while, you know, they come to Haiti, they've been quote unquote trained or experienced in natural resource protection, you know, and they're an expert, and they'll come down and, you know, there are people cutting mangroves in a certain area, and they'll go up to them and start yelling at them that, you know, they shouldn't do that, and it's bad for this, and they need to find something else to do. And you have to be empathetic. You have to understand what the entire situation is. You have to understand, as I just said, that they, you know, don't cut down that tree. You don't eat that day. You don't catch that fish. You don't eat that day.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to work with the local communities, work with the person, the people who are overexploiting the resources, and really try to understand why they're doing what they're doing, which in general we know. But how are we going to get them to now work to help manage and protect their resources so that they can find resources for tomorrow, and so that their kids, when they grow up, can find the same resources and be able to make a decent living from them as well.
Yeah.
So it's a tough one when you're dealing with such levels of poverty.
Yeah, and I guess because like people's needs don't change. Do you know what I mean? Like you said, like people still need to eat, people still need safety, people still need shelter, exactly. And these things. Like you know, no matter what the political or social level is at, those needs are still there and people need them that day. You know, I don't go any days without food. And I think if anyone goes to a country like that, you know, you can say you shouldn't be doing that in that way. It's like, but the needs are still there. So you've got to understand why that is happening. And it's incredibly hard to detach yourself, I'm sure, when you go to, you know, a country that's completely different, or if you haven't been in the country for a while. But how do you manage to actually start to tackle, or maybe tackle is the wrong word, but how do you start to approach biodiversity conservation or, you know, or natural resource management when you've got these levels of political and social instability?
Well, we have to work at the very at the most basic levels. A lot of peer pressure, trying to get local communities, local community people living in these communities to work together and to try to understand that when one person does well or two people do well in the community, everybody does better.
Yeah.
That when one or two people are doing particularly badly, everybody in the community does badly. So things are, you know, the explanations are there, and we can always we always work with I mean, we're local, but we also work with people from each community that we're working in. So, you know, explaining that, you know, you may have, say, five, you know, a community of maybe 5,000 people. So you may have five people in that community who are cutting down mangroves to make charcoal, to make a living so that, you know, they can pay their doctor's bills, eat, send their kids to school, and things like that. The problem is that these five people cutting down the mangroves are putting potentially the other 5,000 at risk if there's a hurricane or, you know, tropical storms and things along those lines. So that's part of the understanding that you have to impart upon the people, not only the charcoal makers, but the people in the community. Is this what you want? I agree. The Haitian saying, you know, I can't, they say, I can't stop him from making a living, which means that they will let people do almost anything because the other person also has to make a living. However, when now that person's making a living is putting you, your family, your livelihood, your home at risk, now you really have to start to weigh, is it worth letting that individual continue to do that and put everybody's lives and livelihoods at risk? So it's a slow process. It will continue to be a slow process unless there's enough support. And by support, I don't just mean funding, but I mean, community support, community understanding for the local communities to be able to begin to understand this. Certainly, funding is needed and required to potentially provide people with propane so they don't need to cut down trees, provide them with sustainable fishing gear so that they stop using damaging methods, and all of these types of change outs of their lives and livelihoods. And that's in part what we're working on as well, is trying to have the coastal communities understand that, you know, it's not just fishing and using any method to fish. You can do apiculture, you can do seaweed farming, you can do breadfruit flour. You can, there are all of these other options, which in most cases they have never heard of or were never able to engage in, which would relieve some of the pressure off of the coastal and marine resources. So again, complete holistic approach where you have to go in. I mean, we can provide, just a step back, we can provide training in anything. We can provide aeronautical training to someone, but if you don't give them an airplane to work on, it's worthless.
Yes, it's pointless.
So, right. So if we provide you with apiculture training, for example, we want to be able to give you at least beehives and equipment and get you going in marketing and all of that.
To actually start.
So, you know, exactly. So this question of training just to train without providing any type of opportunities, I think, is completely worthless. If you're going to train someone in apiculture, yeah, if you need to provide, if you're going to provide somebody training in apiculture, you need to, you know, give them the hand up to be able to use that training in an interesting way. So we're working along all of those lines. We're again alone, growing, but slowly. But Yeah, we have our work cut out for us. It's a heavy, heavy, heavy load, but we're doing the best that we can. And if everybody did the best that they can in the sector that they're best suited in, I think we would all move a lot faster and a lot better everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I applaud your work because it's, you know, this kind of community-led conservation is, you know, worth an applause at the best of times, but when you're tackling it in a country that has that instability, then it's kind of, you know, even more so in some cases respect because I can understand the kind of pressures behind it. The other question I wanted to kind of ask you, this is maybe a not a total sidestep from Haiti, because I'm sure your answer will relate back, but when I saw you, the first talk I saw at the Whitley Fund for Nature People for Planet Summit, the talk I was watching was on about carbon credits or carbon offsetting and kind of, you know, does it work, basically, the easy question of does it work? And I found that talk really, really interesting because I've spent a lot of time when I've been walking around or I've been at work just thinking about carbon offsetting or the talk of biodiversity credits and things like that. I'm really questioning how I feel about it or whether I see it working long term. So it was really interesting to see a talk actually tackle that. I wondered for you, do you believe that that kind of system of carbon offsetting or carbon credits, whatever we're calling it, can or does work for people in Haiti? And what do you think needs to change for a system like that to work?
Yes, and I was on that panel at the event. For us at least, and as I had said a bit during the panel as well, it has to be done right. We need to make sure that if there are such mechanisms put in place that the people who are supposed to benefit the most from it benefit the most from it, and that it's not, you know, the majority of funds is not going towards higher level people or intermediaries who are taking a gigantic cut out of this to benefit themselves. It needs to be regulated. It needs to be You need to be sure that it's being done properly. And also, as I had said, for us at least right now, we have been approached a couple of times for carbon offsetting. We are concentrating on doing the work that we feel needs to be done. We're replanting hundreds of thousands and now millions of mangrove trees with and for local communities. We're replanting fruit trees with and for local communities. And that is the priority. Now, if there is a way to, of course, provide increased income, not only to this type of project in terms of reforestation and rehabilitation of ecosystems, but also provide other types of benefits to the local communities, such as, I don't know, funding for schools or for clinics or for hospitals and things along those lines, I'm all for it. My biggest issue is making sure that it is working properly. I mean, if you're going to, and I understand, I'm not naive in any way, shape, or form. Somebody starts up something like this, and you know they want to make a living, they want to make some good money and all. But if they're taking 90% of the funds and only 10% is reaching the ground, then we've got a problem.
Yeah,
If
you've got a
they're taking
sustainability
a
problem.
reasonable amount, yeah, if they're taking a reasonable amount, you know, I don't know what the percentage would be, but let's use our common sense and call it a reasonable amount, then I think, of course, it would be something which could be beneficial. So again, needs to be regulated, and we must not forget what our vision is. The vision is to help the local communities. We don't want people making money off of the backs of these local communities, and you know, saying we're doing this and that, and a pittance arrives at the local community level, and the others are making 90% profit from it.
So it's kind of a lot. It's a lot of consideration. I think it always falls down to that same thing, isn't it? If it's not regulated, then there's many, many, many holes in a system like this.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I flew to London for the event and all, and of course there's the little tag on the website. You know, do you want to pay $60 for carbon offsets? And how do I know where that money is going or what it's going to do?
Where's the trace
or
in
anything along those lines? Yeah, how can I trace it back? One, and then, you know, do I have the time to go and look up the company and check its credentials and make sure that, you know, it's doing what it's supposed to do and all of that? So yeah,
it's a lot of trust.
There's a whole issue of trust and. I don't know. Again, needs to be regulated and finding some way to ensure that the credentials are up to par.
Yeah, and do you know what? I've just got a feeling. I don't know. This is what my feeling is with it, though. I'm like, is it? Is it going? I don't know. It's
yeah.
It gives me the ick. I think there's something there that I just feel a bit uneasy about.
Exactly. It's a little, no pun intended, a little fishy.
Well, I think that's a perfect
at some
phrase.
Level. Yeah. I want to feel good about it. I want to feel better about it. But right now, I really don't think I can.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. Do you also think, I can't remember who said it on the panel, but there was a, or maybe it was actually a member of the audience making a statement or asking a question, was in your experience, what do communities on the ground feel about this kind of carbon offsetting? Bearing in mind it's often these large corporate companies that are causing problems and then offsetting it. Even it's that kind of hypocrisy kind of, you know, the damage that is being done is affecting people on the ground, especially in Global South and stuff like that. So how do communities feel about that? Saying, well, it's fine for us to keep polluting as long as we are offsetting, which I think that's
exactly
the ick part. So what in your experience, how do communities feel about that?
Right. I think that was to me as well.
Yeah.
I was talking about these companies who may be double dipping.
Yes.
You go in and you wipe out the forest and then make your money. And then you come back in and you say you're going to offset the carbon and make some more money. And the local community potentially doesn't benefit from either event. So in general, in Haiti at least, the local communities are pretty much not aware of anything along these lines. And we haven't really had that conversation with them yet either. So with the communities we're working, they're not really aware of this type of mechanism.
Right. Okay. So it's kind of a still new thing. This is what I mean as well. It's so new. it's so new. I think that's part of the reason why I can't feel comfortable with it, because it's, you know, you're waiting for a system to actually, you can review it over a long period of time. And if it's not a long period, then, well, we haven't seen all the gaps in it yet, have we? So I think that's maybe part of the reason I'm feeling a bit uneasy.
It's also, and I mentioned this also during the event, always better to prevent than to heal. Let's try not to cut down the trees, or try not to make a mess and then have to figure out some weird scheme to try to repair it or to justify our damaging activities. Let's just try to prevent messing up things and then having to try to fix it.
Yeah, it's so true. You could always try not needing to offset.
Right, exactly.
maybe review that.
Yeah, exactly. Let me cut my finger off and then let's see how we can put it back on. How about just don't cut your finger off?
Yeah. how about be fine in the first place? For people and communities in Haiti, what do you think they need and want from wildlife and natural resources, and how do you see that being delivered? You might have already answered a bit of this already.
Sure, no, but In Haiti right now, again, because of the situation and the poverty, and people are basically, in lots of cases, subsistence living. So what they need is to be able to find enough food, basically, to survive. There's not much or huge thought, you know, to making a huge amount of money or, you know, all of that. It's often just a question of, you know, I need to eat today. And that's what they basically need from the environment at this point. They need sustainability so that they can continue to benefit from the resources, and hopefully so that their children and their children's children will be able to benefit, to continue to benefit from the resources. So it's basically subsistence living in most cases. Trying to look a little bit further, you know, protect the resources, using it for tourism, intrinsic value, and things along those lines. That will come. And we're working a little bit on ecotourism. We have a small ecotourism kayaking activity going on right now, in which we're trying to show people that, you know, you can have a turtle, as I said during the event again, have a turtle, and, you know, you can take that turtle and get your 50 bucks for it, kill it and get your 50 bucks for it, and you're done. Or we can help you do ecotourism, and you can, you know, show a tourist that turtle for 50 bucks over and over and over and over and over again. You don't have to cut down the mangrove trees. You can make mangrove honey, for example. The mangrove tree can continue to do all of its ecosystem services. It can protect you from storms, serve as fish nurseries, sequester carbon, everything else. If you leave it there, and you can use it to make mangrove honey. Or you can cut it down and make your bag of charcoal for 50 bucks and you're done. So trying to change that type of mentality, that, you know, ecosystems and biodiversity have other values than simple consumption, that you can make a living off of, is also part of what we're trying to push. And of course, it's not easy because you still have to eat, and the transition is, you know, the transition takes a lot of energy, a lot of funds, a lot of time. But we're in it for the long term, as I said, 32 years now. So we're working, and we're working at it to see how we can push all of this through.
Yeah, well, I applaud your work, and it's been incredible to, like, kind of hear a bit more and learn a bit more about Haiti and the situation on the ground as well. So thank you so much for being on this bonus episode of Into the Wild. I'm thrilled that I could get you on. I only met you very briefly at the Whitley event, so it was nice to be able to kind of connect and learn a bit more. But thank you so much for being on the show and sharing a bit about conservation in Haiti.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan. Thanks for the opportunity, and it was great to be with you today. And if you ever need me again, just let me know.
There we go. A huge thanks to Jean Wiener one more time for coming on to Into the Wild bonus episode. It was a wonderful opportunity to get to chat to him and to hear all about the work in a country like Haiti. Just a reminder to you, like I said at the beginning of this episode, that the Whitley Fund for Nature Awards 2024 are coming up on the 1st of May. Now, if you want to watch these, you can do so on their YouTube account. So make sure you're all set and ready to do that and be inspired by many more people just like Jean that are doing incredible work with communities and wildlife and conservation all around the world. And that just leaves me to say, if you're not following us on social media, make sure you're doing that. In a long week. Make sure you're doing that. Into the Wild Pod on Twitter, Into the Wild Podcast on Instagram. And even though we fully understand these are financially trying times for everyone, if you would like to throw any of your spare pennies or pounds at Into the Wild to help us continue to bring you episodes like you've heard today, then you can visit our Ko-fi account, which is ko-fi.com/Into the Wild Pod. Anything you can give goes back into the Wild to make sure that we can keep platforming the voices that are out there doing the work to protect communities and their surrounding wildlife. But until next time, nerds, look after yourselves, and we'll speak to you on the next episode.